Interview with Harvey Pitt, May 11th, 2007, in Washington, D.C., by Kenneth Durr.
Well, I want to start with touching a little bit on your background and your education. You went to St. John's for law school?
I was a graduate of St. John's University Law School. Actually, I think it's School of Law.
Okay.
Before that, I had graduated from Brooklyn College, City University. So I was the product of a public education. And as I remarked when I had my confirmation hearings for chairman, I was a first-generation American, first-generation college student, first-generation lawyer in my family.
The American dream. So.
It really was and is.
Yeah. I was interested, you know, if there were any professors along the way that sort of set you in the direction you went, that inspired you to follow law or corporate law.
Well, the interesting thing is that when I was in law school, my thought was that I was going to be a labor lawyer. So I took a lot of the electives I was allowed in labor and arbitration and things of that nature. I got into corporate and securities laws almost by a fluke. I was representing my law school in the National Moot Court Competition. In the final round, we argued a case which was based on a then district court case called Fisher against Kletz, K-L-E-T-Z, which was an accounting defalcation case. And we argued it, and I argued it along the way in front of several representatives of the SEC. I was going to go clerk for a federal judge, but the SEC staff people asked me to come down to the SEC and be interviewed for a position, and I did, and was offered a job in a number of the divisions. In those days, you had to take a test, which I took, and a number of divisions offered me a job. But the general counsel's office intrigued me, and I was persuaded that rather than clerking, I should go to the SEC, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Yeah. Who were the people who saw you do that move forward?
In particular, yeah, one, and there are sort of interesting anecdotes about that. One was Mike Eisenberg. His real full name is Meyer Eisenberg, but everybody called him Mike. Donald Feuerstein. Now, what was interesting is Mike ultimately was my boss when I first started at the SEC, one of my bosses, as was Don. When I became chairman, I became his boss because he was back in the general counsel's office. Don Feuerstein left the SEC and became general counsel of Salomon Brothers. And then Salomon Brothers had a bit of a flap over certain treasury bonds. And I wound up representing Donald before the SEC. So
he chose wisely.
It came out well for him. Yeah. But in any event, I just thought it was funny how things sort of came full circle, mm-hmm. as it were.
So you chose the general counsel's office.
Yes.
It just looked more interesting, looked more challenges.
I was very impressed with what the general counsel's office did. It was more my style, and I suppose in part I was intrigued by the fact, I think this is correct, that nobody from St. John's had ever gone to work in the general counsel's office of the SEC. And so I just thought, it looked like a very exciting place to work. The SEC was just an agency that had the highest reputation anyway, and I thought the general counsel's office might be a good spot for me, so that's what I wound up doing.
I wanted to get to that idea of the SEC's reputation. And more specifically, what was the culture, the morale inside the commission when you came in?
The morale and the culture were fabulous. I think people believed in the mandate. When I came to the SEC, which was in August of 1968, Manny Cohn was the chairman, and that was a very special kind of thing because Manny had grown up at the SEC and I believe was the first staffer who became chairman. I may be wrong about that, but I think I'm right. And of course he was also from Brooklyn, which wasn't lost on me. And shortly thereafter, with the change in election, Hamer Budge became the chairman. But the spirit that I saw there was people were very much persuaded that their mission and their mandate was crucial to our capitalist system and economy. And people worked well together. It was a small agency at the time, and it's grown over the years. But people knew each other. They liked each other. There didn't seem to be a lot of internecine warfare going on, at least. Maybe it was because I was so new and so young and so on that maybe that... Maybe I missed some of that, but I don't think so. I think I would have felt it or heard it or seen it if it had existed. So I thought the culture was great, and I formed some lasting friendships there.
Well, I hope we talk about some of those as we move along.
Sure.
But I want to talk about your boss, the general counsel at this point. Mm-hmm. Who was that?
Phil Loomis, or his full name was Philip A. Loomis. Phil was legendary. I have to say I thought he was brilliant. We would work on briefs, and Phil would review the briefs after they'd been really worked over by one of the two number two people, either Walter P. North, or David Ferber. I think it's David E. Ferber. It would be interesting because Phil would call us in, and he would sit there and call in his secretary, who is Ethel Tashman, dictate to her, without looking at a single piece of paper, complete paragraph with citations included. I mean, he was unbelievable. And so Phil was a bit of a character, but
in what way?
Well, at some point, I think by the time I got there, shortly after, he lost his wife, and they were very, very close throughout life. And so sometimes he became forgetful about things and so on. It was clear to me she must have taken incredibly good care of him, but there were always stories. I mean, one of the stories is, at one going away party, I don't know that Phil gave the gift to the right person, so that created what they called the Phil Loomis rule, which was you always had the departing person leaving the general counsel's office sit immediately to the right of Phil. I mean, it was just things like that. As I say, Phil was brilliant. and a very decent person. And we went out to lunch, groups of us almost all the time. Dave Ferber, myself, and some of the other people like Dick Nathan. And Phil Loomis would often join us and so on. And it was great camaraderie and great spirit. And I think everybody admired Phil as a true intellect.
On those lunches, did you talk shop? Did you
talk
about the case?
Oh, we always talked about things. In fact, eventually one of those lunches, many years later, got me ultimately kicked out of the general counsel's office because, and I think this was I think when Brad Cook was general counsel for a period of time, but actually, or maybe when he had gone downstairs to be director of market reg, but. I spun some theory about institutional membership on stock exchanges, and the next thing I knew, I was involved in a massive case involving institutional membership, and which we were very successful in. And eventually, I became the first chief counsel of the Division of Market Regulation. So that's
it. Didn't get you kicked out necessarily. That
yeah, well, it wasn't not kicked out in a bad way.
Well, I know that institutional membership is a huge issue a little later on. What kinds of things were you focusing on in the 68-69?
Well, I remember in that early period, we had a huge number of broker-dealer cases. The commission had really... crackdown on boiler rooms and things of that nature, and so there were a lot of appeals from commission decisions involving putting broker dealers out of business and sanctioning individuals, and so I had a lot of those cases, which I found exciting. We had cases involving the exercise of extraterritorial jurisdiction that I know I had to deal with. We had cases involving the offer and sale of securities by various means and the like. There were big issues on market structure. I mean, so market structure was a very big issue in 68. When I first got there, the commission was looking at fixed commissions. And ultimately, when I was executive assistant to Ray Garrett, we wound up, the commission wound up abolishing fixed rates. But this was starting in the late 60s, and it was a fascinating process. So that was a very major area of concern as well.
Was the commission, in your estimation, pretty much completely behind unfixing commission rates, or was there a lot of debate about that?
I think there was a lot of debate, and to some extent, although I think we take it for granted today, and I have no doubt it was the right decision, it was difficult because the way the fixed rate structure worked, institutional transactions, which were then not nearly as dominant as they are today, but institutional transactions basically subsidized individual transactions. And so you got a fixed rate, and so there were issues about whether investors would do better or do worse under those circumstances. And and the like. But I think by the time the issue really evolved, it was clear that unfixing rates had to be the right way to go. As I say, today, and even by the time the Garrett Commission did it, it was fairly self-evident. I still think it was changing, almost 200 years of history, and so doing something like that is no small feat.
Right. Well, in the area of market structure, another big issue that I know came along and sort of peaked in the early 70s was the idea of a centralized market, or allowing traders to go off of the New York Stock Exchange onto other exchanges. Was this also surfacing at this point?
Oh, yes. There were a lot of rules. For example, in those days, the New York Stock Exchange had Rule 394, which then became 390. Yes, they changed the numerology, and that does create confusions. The SEC has done it, too. It used to be a Rule 2E, and now it's a Rule 102E. And so, but exchange had a lot of rules that required people who were members of the exchange to do all trades in New York Stock Exchange listed securities on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. This was troublesome because the so-called third market was evolving. And one of the difficulties you have is that if you can trade in stock in multiple markets, there will be competition on the prices. But if you have a rule that prevents people from doing that, or at least some people from doing that, that may prevent people from getting the best price or the best execution that they're capable of. So this was a very significant issue, and it really dictated a major change in the exchanges, which were still undergoing. I mean, it's still ongoing, but ultimately 390 was repealed, and the ability of people to trade listed stocks in venues where they weren't listed, or unlisted trading privileges, became taken for granted. And at one point, the New York Stock Exchange had 100% of the volume in New York Stock Exchange listed securities. Today, I think that number is about 50% or 60%. So it's clearly made a huge difference, and people are constantly looking for other venues, and that competition has worked ultimately to reduce transaction costs and the price of securities. So I think it's all been very, very positive. But again, when you go back in time and are confronting the change, it became very difficult. So that whole market structure issue is important. With respect to, you are right, the reference to a central market system, the commission also looked at how you tie together all of the various marketplaces, and how you provide more competition. What was interesting is that in the 75 Act amendments, which were before Sarbanes-Oxley, the major revision of the securities law since their inception, Congress decided to call it a national market system instead of a central market system. That was the source of much humor at the SEC. I think some people thought a central market system sounded communistic in some way and so on. So a national market system sounded more patriotic. Particularly under Bill Casey as chairman, the commission really started looking at a lot of critical issues, and market structure was very definitely a major area of concern. Fixed rates, off-floor trading, who could be members of exchanges, and the like, all of which led to all sorts of activity by the SEC, and I think it was an incredibly active period in the agency's history.
Well, getting into that, you had your career had a small jump where you became a legal assistant to one of the commissioners.
Oh, yes. Well, I had been, you know, in, I started in 68, and in early 69, Frank Wheat, who was a commissioner, needed a legal assistant, and I was recommended, I think, probably by Don Feuerstein and Mike Eisenberg, I don't know, but I was recommended by people in the general counsel's, I'm sure, because I didn't know Frank at all up until that point. And so he interviewed me and decided to bring me on as a legal assistant, and that was absolutely a phenomenal experience for me, because I was at the agency maybe 6, 7, 8 months, and had seen it through the prism of the general counsel's office, but seeing the agency through the prism of a commissioner was really eye-opening and, for me, quite dramatic, because the commissioner saw everything. And the way the commission operated in those days was quite fascinating. Frank was a Democrat on the commission. Had been a very highly respected corporate lawyer in private practice at Gibson Dunn. I had to do just about everything, you know, cover all sorts of subjects, and Frank taught me a lot about how the commission operated and so on. He was, I thought, just an incredibly gifted human being. He's very smart, but he's also a very decent person. I mean, he was somebody I enjoyed working for. I admired him, and I suppose in some senses he was one of my first mentors. But he had a number of quirks in his personality. The first day I went to work in my new office, I got in early, and all of a sudden I heard this huffing and puffing and wheezing, and I got up to see what was going on, and it was Frank. His office, which was in the building at 500 North Capitol Street, was on the 7th floor. And what Frank would do is he would never take the elevator. He would climb the steps 2 at a time at a run. He was into mountain climbing and hiking and things of that nature. So by the time he had taken 7 flights 2 steps at a time, he was clearly out of breath and so on. That was one of his quirks. The other quirk that I found for me was eye-opening was Frank had a very strange filing system, which I'm told many old-time lawyers did. He kept all of his piles of paper on the floor surrounding his desk, and so if you went over to talk to him, you had to be very careful not to knock anything over and so on. But Frank was just interested in so much. He had done the Wheat Report, which was a major contribution to the development of the federal securities laws by combining the 33 and 34 Act approaches to disclosure. The concept in the statute is the 33 Act governs the issuance of securities and the 34 Act governs the trading. And the effort was to integrate the disclosure process so that there could be reference to and reliance upon disclosures made in each area. And that was an idea that had been circulated in 64 by Milton Cohn, who had an illustrious history as the director of the SEC's special study of the securities markets. And Frank turned that idea with his governance of the Wheat Commission, Wheat Committee, into a reality. It was a brilliant job, and a lot of the disclosure achievements and developments that the SEC has presided over were started by Frank. Anyway, I got to Frank after he had finished the Wheat Report and started working with him. And Frank was just into every issue. I learned from Frank how a commissioner is supposed to function. It's a sort of interesting. You just would watch him. He read everything meticulously. He knew a lot, and he would have me, he would tell me, to raise any issue I wanted. And so I took him literally. Sometimes he had to restrain my enthusiasm, but I just learned worlds from him as a result of working with him.
Did you see the commission in action?
Oh, yes.
Sit with Frank Wheat?
Yes, I would sit in the back of the room and watch what would go on, and with the other legal assistants. In those days, commissioners only had one legal assistant. I think today they now have three, and I think the chairman has four. I think I had four when I was chairman. I don't know. But in those days, I was it. I was his law clerk. And I watched the commission meeting. And one of the things that was most interesting was that Frank, as I mentioned, was a Democrat, but the person he was closest to on the commission was Dick Smith, who was a Republican. One of the things that showed me was that the securities laws were really not supposed to be about politics. They were supposed to be about substance. So I enjoyed watching the interaction. There was Frank, Dick Smith, Manny Cohn, Hugh Owens. I'm trying to think. Owen Hamer Budge, and who became the chairman after Nixon became president. But the commission functioned quite well, I thought, and they all seemed to respect each other, but there were, little intrigues that would go on. People were trying to get ahead of issues. And the great thing about Frank was he was always interested in getting involved in important issues. So he just would dispatch me. I mean, the first lesson he taught me was never ask anyone to come up to your office. You always go to somebody else's office. And Frank would do that. He felt that being a legal assistant to a commissioner, it might rub some staff members the wrong way if you summoned them or seemed to be summoning them to your office. Instead, his instruction to me was I was always to go out and walk to whoever's office it was and meet them in their office and show them the respect. And that, it didn't matter who it was. And all the time I was his legal assistant, the only time I ever had meetings in my office were with people from the general counsel's office. General counsel's office was on the seventh floor, and Frank Wheat's office was on the seventh floor. And I had held on to some cases that I had been working on in the general counsel's office. So sometimes people would just wander in, and we would talk about cases, but that was at their urging, not at mine. The only thing I used my office for was just to sit there and do my reading and so on. We didn't have computers, of course, or anything of that nature. And in those days, the commission had a lot of tasks that they've since delegated away, and mercifully so. But
what kind of tasks?
Every public offering had to be declared effective by the commission. And in those early days, in 69, when I was there, the commissioners each had a vote on these things. Well, that meant that their legal assistant had to read every registration statement that came through. As you can well imagine, there are more important things for the commission, I think, to be doing, but in those days it was significant. And the thing for me was, it was a great time to get there because having never worked in the Division of Corporation Finance, I was able to learn about the division's important tasks, even though I wasn't part of the division's team, and that was very valuable to me. So I didn't and don't regret that, but I laugh now because given the issues that the commission has to deal with, it would strike me as Byzantine to require the commissioners to read registration statements. But we did have to do that in those days.
The workload would be, it's just unimaginable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Did you work with people in court then?
Oh, yes. I worked with a whole variety. One of the people I worked most closely with, who I became very good friends with and went through some travails together with, was Dick Rowe. Dick Rowe left, was my predecessor as Frank Wheat's legal assistant. And after the Wheat report, Dick went down to Corp Fin. I think he had come from Corp Fin. But in any event, over the years, Dick and I became very close. He and I, when we had foreign payments problems, he became director of the Division of Corporation Finance, and I became general counsel. Had one incident where we were issued a forthwith subpoena by members Harley Stagger's investigations committee, and John Moss in particular, and so we were hauled over there and had to testify, and Dick and I went through a lot together. We were also both pipe smokers at the time. I gave up smoking many, many years ago, and I don't know that Dick has or did, but in those days we both were pipe smokers, so that was another bond we had.
Well, we get to when you came, I guess, back to the general counsel's office, and you're a special counsel to the general counsel. And this would be the Casey years, I guess. Is that right, or was Henry Burke still?
Well, at some point, yeah, I guess. Um, was 3 years in, so it was about 71, thereabouts. I think Casey was chairman. I became a special counsel in the office of the general counsel. It was, I worked under Dave Ferber most of the time, although there were occasions when I worked for Walter North. I began supervising younger attorneys in the general counsel's office, particularly in connection with briefs and so on. In those days, everyone did everything in the general counsel's office. It has increased exponentially in its size since those days, and you now have very discrete units, some people that do amicus briefs, some people that do appellate briefs, some people do legislation, other people do counseling. So there are a whole variety of different functions, but in those days everyone did everything. And that meant it was a very well-rounded education, but in those days you became a special counsel, or became eligible to be a special counsel, I guess, after 3 years. I started as a GS-11, and then I, as a special counsel, I became a GS-14. So that was good. But I'll never forget. We had one incident because. We always played musical chairs with the offices in the general counsel's office. There was a steady progression, and I had an interior office, although it was in the back bullpen in the general counsel's office. I had a big poster of a window in my office, which I thought was funny. I don't know whether others agreed with it, but in any event, one of the things that I recall vividly is Dave Ferber coming into my office and telling me that somebody had left, and now that I was a special counsel, I could move into a certain window office. And it really wasn't that important to me. And so I said, well, I appreciate it, but I think I'll just stay here. And Dave got the crossest and most stern look on his face, and he said, I have just spent a half an hour arguing with Walter North over which side of the office is going to get that office, and you are moving. So I moved. Efforts that we had in working on you know, major briefs and things like that, working with Dave Ferber was just an incredible education. He was a true, dedicated civil servant. I think he came to the commission in 42. And working on brief with him was it was tough love and painful, but incredibly educational.
So you'd give him a draft and he'd destroy it. That sort of thing.
Well, first you'd give the draft to one of the supervisors. When you were a staff attorney, you'd give it either to special counsel or an assistant general counsel. Those were the two levels. You didn't have both, but you had one or the other. And then from there, it would go into Dave. Dave worked on briefs the old-fashioned way. He basically would sit there and make you go over every single word in the brief. Do you need me to stop?
I'm just wondering about this thing. It stops.
Okay, I'm sorry if I'm going on too long.
You're doing great.
But, you know, Dave went over every single word in a brief. A Ferber brief was so thoroughly reviewed. And if you made any factual statements in the statement of facts, Dave's requirement was you had to be able to prove by citing to the record every single fact that you put in a brief. I mean, he was truly a master. And in those days, of course, everything was cut and paste. There were no computers. There were no electronic typewriters at first. And this created problems because in the Southern District of New York, you had to file a ribbon original, which was not easy to achieve and so on and so forth. But Dave's secretary was a woman named Diana Barry, and she was magnificent. She put up with Dave's persnicketiness, but as we all did. But his briefs, he was very, very proud of. And this was very important to him, and by definition, it meant it was important to all of us. And I don't think anybody could have gotten a better education on how to write than I got from that process. Don Feuerstein was brilliant and a brilliant writer. I found that his work got changed far less by Dave Ferber than many other people and so on. And that, of course, was the game you played with yourself, was I was going to write a brief that nobody would change. And you kept striving to get there, but it was just a phenomenal education for me.
Well, you mentioned earlier that when Bill Casey came in, it was a very active period. A lot of things were happening. And this would have been that time when you were working in the general counsel's office. Did Bill Casey's philosophy of regulation, was it different from what had come before? Did he change the sort of cases that the general counsel's office dealt with that way?
No, not really, because effectively the cases the general counsel's office had were dictated by what was in the pipeline, either through the enforcement division or through the opinions section where the commission would issue opinions. The opinions office was headed by a fellow named Leonard Helfenstein, and people used to refer to Leonard as the sixth commissioner. He was an outstanding writer, and his opinions were great. When Casey came in, one of the things that was interesting is I think Leonard had retired. And Casey appointed Bernie Wexler to head up the opinion writing office. And one thing that was interesting, Bernie Wexler had been a speech writer for Casey, and he'd been a bankruptcy lawyer and so on. Bernie was a real character. He was very smart, but he was definitely a character. And when Ray Garrett became chairman, he would tear what little hair of his was left when he would read some of Bernie's opinions. Bernie was given to great poetic license and flair in these opinions. I don't think the opinions of the commission ever read as well as when Bernie was there, but for a conservative traditionalist like Ray Garrett, it was definitely hair-pulling time. But Casey didn't change the workload of the general counsel's office all that much, but he did change, in my view, the commission's perspective on things. As I say, he Bill used a lot of advisory committees, something that went out of vogue when Congress passed the Advisory Committee Act, and now everything had to be done in public instead of the way Bill's advisory committees did. But he not only looked at market structure, he looked at the enforcement division, which had theretofore been almost untouchable, and Bill wound up reorganizing the commission by separating trading and markets into two divisions, the Division of Enforcement and the Division of Market Regulation.
What was behind that decision? I mean, there had been no Division of Enforcement, so he created one.
Right. I think there were a couple of things behind it. One of Bill's concerns, first and foremost, was that agencies that regulate shouldn't be able to use enforcement as the vehicle for changing the law. And separating enforcement would, number one, make certain that the enforcement division couldn't be in a position of, in effect, creating laws. Another thing I think he thought is that it would be far more efficient. Each division had its own enforcement staff. And what he did was he consolidated them all into the enforcement division. And that meant that you had people who were focusing on how to try cases administratively or how to bring cases. We're doing it better, and by splitting trading in markets, he ensured that the regulatory function of the division, market regulatory function, was given full attention. And I think he saw the world moving. I think it was a good vision on his part, but he saw the world moving and was very much concerned that the division not be diverted with its own enforcement dockets and so on and so forth. And I think that was a very major change in the way the agency operated. And I think it was very constructive and for the best. But he had a review of the enforcement process by John Wells, who was a partner at Rogers and Wells, what became Rogers and Wells. And that led to the so-called development of Wells submissions and the like, which I thought was a very, today we take it for granted that if somebody is going to be sued by the agency usually gives that person a choice, a chance rather, to address why he, she, it shouldn't be sued and why they don't think their conduct violated the law and so on. But that was initiated by the Wells Committee. And the Wells Committee made a lot of recommendations for enforcement, many of which were adopted, some of which weren't, but was a very novel approach to enforcement. And these were the types of things that Casey was doing in engineering. It was really very impressive.
Well, you were talking about Casey's advisory committees, and eventually you went into market reg. But before you did that, there was something called the Institutional Investor Study that you were associated with.
Oh, yes. Well, Congress in, I'm trying to think when, but I think it was 68 or thereabouts, or it may have been 70. Congress had directed, maybe it was 70, yeah. Congress had directed that the SEC study the trading activities of institutional investors and make a report to Congress with recommendations. Percentage of institutional investors was increasing. In those days, it was mostly mutual funds. There were large institutions, bank, trust departments and the like, and other forms of collective investment. And so the concern was we didn't really understand a lot about this, and the commission was directed to do a review. The commission hired a number of econometricians, and they did the report, and after they had done it, people discovered that while these people were very good with theory and with numbers, they weren't quite as good with words in every case. And so you had a report, but it really wasn't ready to see the light of day. And so Don Feuerstein, who had gone to work for the Institutional Investor Study, corralled four staff attorneys, and I was one of them. And we were given chapters of the report, and we were told not to change the conclusions, obviously, but to put it in English. And that got me into a whole new world of institutional investors and so on. I worked on chapters involving the thesis that maybe there was parallel trading by institutions, the thought that institutions traded in the same direction, and of course that was completely disproved by the study. So the chapter was really very important in explaining that institutions were like any investors. Some wanted to buy, some wanted to sell. They provided liquidity to the marketplace and so on.
I was trying to figure out the idea of all trading in the same direction. So you're saying the expectation was that all institutions would buy at the same time and sell at the same time.
Right. Okay. And that was completely disproved by the study, which stands to reason, of course, but nonetheless it was. And so I worked on a couple of chapters on the study and revised them, edited them. I had to really get myself into a whole different, first of all, a whole different area, because I had not dealt with this before, but also learn to write, learn to read an economist's views and then translate it into English, which for some of the people who worked on these things was clearly a second language, and so on. But
this would seem to be very difficult coming in at the, you know, when the thing's essentially done.
Yeah, it was, but it was fascinating. So we and it was very enjoyable. And as I say, there were four of us, you know, who did it, and it was incredibly broadening for me.
Well, I know that when folks have contrasted the Institutional Investor Study with the Special Study, the legendary Special Study, the Institutional Investor Study comes up short.
It does.
And if you, looking at the way it was dealt with there, how do you think it should have been handled?
Well, I think the notion was that the institutional study should be an economic study. That's a decision with which I agree 100%. But by definition, since the special study was a legal study and to a large extent a case study, but not really an economic study, it was more in the mode of what's wrong with our markets, how do we fix them. The institutional investor study was how do institutions affect our markets? And so you start from a very different point of view. I think that the special study was groundbreaking because it found abuses in the way the markets worked provided case studies and so on, and so it deserves its exalted status. But I think the institutional investor study probably deserves better than it got, but it wasn't ever intended to be this wild expose, and it wasn't approached that way. So I think it was very different type of study. The commissioner who was assigned to oversee the institutional investor study was none other than Dick Smith. And he and Feuerstein were very close as well. That's one of the reasons why Feuerstein became one of the deputy directors of the institutional investor study, and I thought he did a terrific job.
Okay. Well, after that, I was into market reg, and here you're really looking at the structure of the markets.
Yes. As a result of my work on institutional membership, part of the problem had been, Casey's notion was that there was an inherent inconsistency, which I think is correct, between having fixed commission rates on the one hand and yet having institutional membership on the other. And what the regional exchanges had been doing was they were charging fixed rates, just the way the New York Stock Exchange, American Stock Exchange were. But they were allowing institutions to join and thereby lower the price of trading because the intra-member price was not fixed. That was a subject of negotiation. And Casey's thought was either you should get rid of fixed rates, which nobody seemed willing to do quite at that time. As I say, that took Ray Garrett to do. Or you shouldn't allow institutional membership. And Casey went to Congress and tried to get Congress to give the SEC authority to preclude institutional membership. And Congress turned it down. I couldn't understand why Casey wanted legislation because I thought the SEC already had the power to do it. And that was my luncheon discussion with Brad Cook. And Brad mentioned it to Casey, and the next thing I knew, I had been put in charge of this entire proceeding on institutional membership. And the advantage of it was I was able to start from the concept and work all the way through to including the litigation. What I enjoyed about that was first coming up with the theories as to why the commission could do this, then structuring the hearings that we held on institutional membership, Then writing what at that time was a huge release. It was just shy of 200 pages and had 537 footnotes and so on and so forth. Developed a rule, and then of course the commission got sued over the rule. This was 19B2 was the rule, and so the commission got sued, and of course, having engineered this whole thing, I worked on the brief, and I remember we argued the case. I argued the case in the Third Circuit. The Justice Department was opposed to the SEC. The state of Connecticut was opposed, and so on. The Philadelphia, then it was the PBW, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Washington Stock Exchange was opposed. So everyone opposed the SEC, and I wrote the brief. Ferber edited it. Was never going to argue that case because he didn't really understand how the markets operate, and I had been through this, so he suggested that I argue it, which I was willing to do. And I did argue it in the Third Circuit, and the commission won the case. It was just a fascinating experience in not just developing a rule, but creating the entire process to get to that rule, which was very enjoyable for me. So
You set yourself up to be sued?
No, I set myself up to win a lawsuit. In other words, the advantage I had was that at the same time that we were setting this up, I knew we were going to be sued. There was too much money at stake. The people were going to sue us. So my thought was, well, how do I constantly limit the possibilities for successful suit, even though what we wanted to do was going to cause a lot of screaming and yelling, which it wound up doing. And that's what I found so much fun. So we didn't set ourselves up for suit. We set ourselves up to try and win a lawsuit because no step was taken without thinking through what the implications would be on litigation. And I have to say I was very fortunate to be able to work on that. And I really enjoyed my efforts there, and they were successful.
What was the theory behind 19B?
Well, the theory was this, that if you are going to charge people fixed rates and you couldn't somehow allow some people to escape that but others not to escape that, you had to be fair to people. And so what we said was, if somebody is going to be a member of an exchange, what they should be doing is using their position to serve the public. And if they weren't doing that at least 80% of the time, then they really weren't truly a member of an exchange. They were something else. They were somebody who had found a way by paying a membership fee to get reduced rates, and that was something we were going to avoid. And Section 19B gave the commission the power to change the rules of any registered national securities exchange, either by rule or by order. And, I mean, some of the arguments that people were making were that we had to do it by order because this was adversarial. We took the position that we would ultimately adopt a rule, but we did allow limited forms of cross-examination. In other words, we had people give statements, and then we allowed people to suggest questions and so on, but never fully went the route of doing this as, you know, a full-blown trial-type proceeding and so on. And that was one of the issues that we confronted in setting this up. And the commission had really never done a proceeding like this under 19B. It was the first one, and it was, for all intents and purposes, the last one quite like this, because even though there have been more 19B rules, in 1975, Congress revised the statute and changed the process significantly. But by that time, we'd already unfixed commission rates, and we'd decoupled membership from compensation for transactions, and that was what was critical.
How long did this process take?
That's a good question. I think our rulemaking process took about a year or so, and then because there was a direct appeal to the Court of Appeals, I think it may have taken another 6 months or so. But I worked very closely with a fellow named Bob Lewis, who had been in market reg with me. He was a special counsel and then ultimately became an associate director. Bob and I started at the SEC on the exact same day in August of 1968. And we remained friends up until his tragic passing a number of years ago. But Bob and I were very, very close, and we had a lot of fun working on the commission's release that adopted the rule. And between the two of us, we pretty much crafted most of 19B2. And Bill Casey was so interested in this that he actually reviewed our drafts, and we had friendly competition because Casey was not an editor by any means, but he would make little marginal notes, and we compared how many excellents each one of us got, so and so forth. But it was we worked round the clock, but it was a very intriguing issue and problem, and we figured out how to use the laws we already had to get the result we wanted, and that was what the commission was looking for. So it was great fun.
Well, let's move up a little bit again.
Yeah, how long, by the way?
Yeah, I understand you've got 2 hours.
Yeah.
So we can go 2 hours. And
yeah, that's great. And we can do it again.
Sounds great.
Because I can just go on and on and on and so on and so forth.
I know you've got things to do.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk a little bit about chairman. Bill Casey, clearly, you know, a pretty strong leader.
Yes.
Now, I understand that Brad Cook's whole approach was essentially to continue what Casey had put in place. Did it work out that way?
It's hard to say because he wasn't in the job long enough. Brad was only there six weeks. Brad was the youngest chairman, I think, in the agency's history, or if not the youngest, one of the youngest. He was definitely very young. I think, you know, he had been general counsel, then he'd been director of market reg. I had expected when he became chairman, because I had worked with Brad so much, that I was probably going to go up to his office and become his executive assistant. For very selfless reasons, he didn't bring me up to his office. He already knew that there were problems going on, and decided that he wouldn't promote me, because if he did and something wound up happening, that he would taint my career. So it was a very selfless act. I am very, very fond of Brad. I think he was a very astute person. I think he has a very good heart, and I was very disappointed to see what happened, but like many of us, Brad was somebody who came to the agency and fell in love with it. I had been at the agency since 68, and this was probably around 72, I think. And I adored the agency. I'd come giving the agency a 3-year commitment. And when I understood that I had to give the 3-year commitment, it seemed like a long time to me. But after 3 years, I was completely hooked. I guess you could say I was addicted on the SEC. I just thought it was a great place. The people I met were great. The issues were fascinating, and so on and so forth. And Brad's rise to become chairman of the agency, I thought, was both fabulous for the agency, and I thought was going to be personally fabulous, because I worked so closely with him. And unfortunately, it didn't turn out that way. But his goal was to continue a lot of the Casey initiatives and the like, and he just didn't get the chance. And
so, well, you got the chance for the executive assistant position.
Well, it was interesting because Ray Garrett came in, and I didn't know Ray from a hole in the wall. But Ray was determined not to keep on anybody who'd been in the chairman's office before he got there, given some of the circumstances, which is why Brad's selfless act made it possible for me to move up. But in any event, Brad recommended me. I think other people recommended me to Ray, and Ray interviewed me. And it was interesting because he said he wanted to hire me and be his executive assistant, but he also said he was thinking of hiring another executive assistant, and that I would be overseeing substance, and this other executive assistant would be overseeing political relations with Congress and the like and so on, which nobody ever assumed I had any knowledge of, etc. What was fascinating about it was, although he interviewed a number of people, he quickly decided that it was just going to be me. We did bring in a fellow named Ted Burrow to be director of congressional relations. And Ted worked for me as well as, you know, under Ray and so on and so forth. And so, you know, it was a great opportunity. Ray was really like a surrogate father to me. I mean, my own father had a sixth grade education and had very little understanding of what I did or what the securities laws were all about. Ray was quintessentially one of the most brilliant lawyers of all, and he took me under his wing, and part of what happened with Ray was his wife and a lot of his family were in Chicago, and Ray lived out of an apartment at 3 Washington Circle, whatever, the Washington Hotel there. It's not the Washington Hotel, Washington Circle Hotel. And so Ray was here alone. His family was away, and he basically worked here from Monday to Friday. So just as he was sort of a surrogate father to me, I sort of was a surrogate son to him. And his own son had problems. He'd had some drug and alcohol problems and so on. And Ray and I just became incredibly close. I mean, I admired that man as much as I think I could admire anybody. And he was somebody who had turned down the request to become chairman several times. And then finally, when Brad resigned, Al Haig, who was Nixon's chief of staff, called Ray and finally made the one appeal that Ray couldn't resist. He appealed to Ray's sense of patriotism. Ray was a very conservative, very patriotic person. And when Haig said, "Your country needs you," Ray could not really turn that down. So he came in. He did insist that the Democrat that was also a slot vacant be Al Summers. And Ray and Al were very close originally in private practice, but on the commission they were exceedingly close as well. But Ray is just a remarkable human being, and I loved him dearly, and you know, was very, very grateful for the opportunity to work for him. He was just was an incredible teacher, and somebody who you could learn about you know, just by keeping quiet and watching him.
Well, what did he want to do?
Well, the most important thing he wanted to do with the commission was restore its morale. And Ray was just a very down-to-earth person. As brilliant as Ray was, and he was brilliant, and he had this deep, mellifluous voice and his vocabulary, and so he was incredible. But he was so down to earth. He was an MCP, a male chauvinist pig, and all of the women on the staff loved him. And by that I mean he just thought that you were courteous to women and polite, and he would open doors for them and so on. He appointed women to senior positions at the commission, so he wasn't biased or anything, but he was definitely old school, and he was very, very conservative, just in terms of his approach to life. I'm not talking politically, and so I'm saying, you know, this is a man who was very impressed with doing the right thing and behaving properly and things of that nature. So it was eye-opening. My life with Ray changed dramatically because, first of all, I was not much of a drinker. I often thought that if I could put Ray into competition against anybody in the world, we could make a fortune. So Ray had a very good appetite. And so I learned to drink martinis from Ray. I'd never had a martini in my life until I went to work for Ray. I learned to fly first class. In those days, SEC chairman flew first class, and as his executive assistant, I flew with him. I'd never been first class on a plane. I didn't do that much traveling and so on. I pretty much went everywhere with Ray and did almost everything, you know, on almost all the issues with him. And it was just such a learning experience. It was incredible. And I even named my younger son's middle name is Garrett, after Ray.
Well, he came in at a point when all these issues that have been bubbling along are really getting ready to be done or bubble over or something like that. What was his position, for example, on the idea of unfixing commissioners, which is not a conservative thing to do?
No, it's not a conservative thing to do. But Ray was, in addition to being a conservative, he was a pragmatist. And the way he explained it, and we had to write speeches on this, so I remember it well, he said, rates are going to be unfixed. And either the Justice Department or the courts are going to do it to the industry, or the SEC is going to do it. And he said, from everybody's perspective, it will be a whole lot better if the SEC does it than if either justice or the courts do it. And so that way we could have a phase-in of unfixed rates. And I remember the commissioners, and it was Ray, Al Sommer, Phil Loomis, John Evans, I'm trying to think, maybe first it was Hugh Owens, then maybe Irv Pollack. But the commission met in my house in Potomac to discuss unfixing rates. They didn't want to do it. In those days, there was no Sunshine Act, and the wood that we were back then, back there then. But they didn't want to do this in front of the staff, so it was the commissioners. And what Ray did was he led the commissioners through the issues, and it was unlike any commission meeting you ever saw, because everybody had their points of view as to what, you know, to do. And through a series of meetings, and we had several of them at my house, the commission worked it out. And I was a witness to, you know, I'd like to say that I played some role in this, which I did, but this was leadership of the most incredible sort, because Ray knew where he wanted to go, but he wanted all of the commissioners to get there, and he wanted it to be unanimous. And one of the things I saw from that commission is all of these people idolized Ray. I mean, they all thought the world of Ray. And so they were five very different people, but they worked so constructively together. And there were differences. You know, John Evans was an economist on the commission, and I became very close with John. I liked John a lot. John and Ray were not often of the same view on a lot of issues. John wasn't as conservative as I think Ray was. But John would always watch to see whether Ray cared or not. If Ray didn't care, John was very vocal. If Ray cared, John would find a way to compromise some of his views, making sure that Ray understood, you know, what some of the countervailing considerations were. And I saw that through all five of them. It was, I thought, one of the golden eras of the commission. When Ray was chairman, the staff would come up and sit in the room to watch issues discussed that had absolutely nothing to do with their day-to-day functions. It was an incredible education. People just sat there and watched Ray and Al and Phil do all of their activities. Irv was brilliant. John Evans as the economist. It was just a magical, I think it was a very magical time, and Ray succeeded in, you know, elevating the way the commission approached issues, and I think was a very, very popular chairman. I think Bill Casey was a very, very effective chairman. But when Bill was out of town, other commissioners would swipe. Because Bill was not only very effective, he was somewhat authoritarian. Ray was very much down to earth and sometimes to the point of doing things that would shock me. I remember one time, I don't remember what the matter was now, and it probably doesn't matter, but there was an enforcement recommendation on the calendar, and Ray and I would talk about every item on the calendar before he went into a meeting, and he was particularly incensed with this enforcement recommendation. It was really over the top, and I have to say, I agreed with him. And so he talked about it, and he said, this is just, you know, this is just going too far. They go into the meeting, and I sat in the back of the room and watched. And Ray called the matter, and unlike what he usually did, he called the matter but invited others to speak. And I noticed that both John Evans and Irv Pollack were looking at Ray, and Ray wasn't saying anything, except finally he sort of indicated that he disagreed with the recommendation. By this time, all four of the others had pretty much come out in support of the recommendation, and the vote went 4-1. Now, this was a vote he could have won. And so when we walked back into his office, I looked at him and I said, "What the heck were you doing out there? I mean, you had that vote won." And he said, "I know, Harvey," he said, "but sometimes it's important for the chairman to lose." And that made a very important impression on me, but I was very impressed with the kind of person. Ray had zero guile. He could not put on any pretense. He couldn't affect any air. He was smart enough so that he could have if he wanted to, and that voice would have made Walter Cronkite jealous. I mean, he just was phenomenal. But Ray was definitely not one to sort of put on airs or put himself over anyone. He knew almost everyone on the staff by name. Everyone called him Ray, which was important to me. I when I became chairman, I wanted everyone on the staff to call me Harvey, and so on.
There were a lot of lessons learned at that.
I could not have learned more lessons at all. And Ray was. He was just stupendous. His life was cut very short because he was a constant smoker. But I figure if lung cancer didn't get him, then maybe liver cancer would have gotten him at some point. But Ray was somebody who lived life to its fullest. And he was just a great human being and somebody I love very deeply.
Well, I have appreciated this. I think this is probably a good place to stop.
That's fine. Mm-hmm.